Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
The Unfair Advantage is an expose of the myths behind startup success and a blueprint for harnessing the things that really matter. Drawing on over two decades of hands-on experience, Asha Lee and Hassan Kuba offer a unique framework for assessing your external circumstances and your internal strengths. Hard work and grit aren't always enough, so they explore the importance of money, intelligence, location, education, expertise, status, and luck in the journey to success. Joining us this morning is one of the authors. Hassan Kuba, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start off with, you know, having you explain why you wrote the book and how long did it take you to write it?
Well, we wrote the book because we were investing in tech startups at the time. And we'd see a lot of people come in and ask for funding. It was a bit like Shark Tank. And we just knew that there's a difference between the ones that we could see that they might have what it takes and the ones which we knew they're going to struggle to raise funding. They're going to struggle with their business idea. And we thought, what is the difference that makes a difference? And we started to kind of think about this concept and start to write down this idea of the unfair advantage. If you have an unfair advantage and you're going to leverage it with your business idea, then you're more likely to succeed.
You know, when you hear the title unfair advantage, one's immediate reaction might be, well, wow, I don't have those unfair advantages. Somebody else does. So how can this help me? Talk to us a little bit about what you mean by unfair advantage and why everyone might be able to find one that they have.
So we're kind of taught that, you know, success is all about hard work, grit, determination, and that's what it takes to succeed. You know, nose to the grindstone, and you've got to really work hard to make it happen. And the reality is that hard work is just table stakes. You need hard work, of course, but it's not enough. How many nurses do you know that work hard? How many janitors do you know that work hard? Obviously, so clearly it's not enough. What you need is an unfair advantage. But as you said, people often think that other people have unfair advantages, but I don't. And actually, we all have unfair advantages. And the reason we all have them is, number one, you can audit and figure out all the different types of unfair advantages, not just the obvious ones like having money, but also, number two, because they're double-edged swords. So having something like having little money can also increase your creativity and your resourcefulness. So you can kind of turn a disadvantage into an advantage with the right mindset.
So, you know, what you're looking at is how does success work? And so can you take us into that a little bit as far as, you know, how are you defining success? And then as well, it seems like, you know, as you said, we've all been told just more hard work, nose to the grindstone, you'll get it done. But you're saying that's not what you found from your review of these companies?
That's right. Yeah. So first of all, success is, everybody needs to define success for themselves. But usually what you see on the covers of, you know, Fortune and Forbes magazines and things like that is the typical thing that people think about success. They want to, you know, become millionaires or multimillionaires, or some people want fame, or some people want kind of freedom and just kind of to design their own lifestyle. So whatever that means for you, you need to make sure to define it for yourself and not have society define it for you. That's number one. But then if we talk about success in terms of, like, let's say as an investor, a success is to get a return on your investment. So it's kind of more binary in that sense, or you can kind of quantify it. When it comes to success, it will come out not just from the hard work. It also comes from figuring out what you have that's unique about you and unique about your founding team. So we were working with very early stage businesses when they were just kind of the idea stage. They were just putting their team together. They were just getting started building a product. So how do you judge them? You have to judge them based on the team. This is what all investors do, and maybe they don't talk about it as much, but they're judging it based on the team. It's like, what do you bet on, the jockey or the horse? And you're betting on the jockey. So the horse is like the business idea, and the jockey is the founders of the business, the entrepreneurs. And you have to look at, what do they have? So that's inner strengths and talents. Let's say they have some expertise. Let's say they're good at, you know, programming and coding, or let's say they're really good at design. And that's kind of an expertise that they might have. But you can also look at external things, such as, do they have the networks and the contacts to be able to get into the companies that they want to sell to, for example. So it's the internal and external strengths of the startup founders.
Which is kind of a segue into the definition of an unfair advantage. We all know that one would intuitively think, okay, having a lot of money would be an unfair advantage, but that's just one of many types of unfair advantages you talk about in the book. Let's flesh out what some of the other types of unfair advantages might be.
Absolutely. So we call it the MILES framework. So MILES is the acronym, and M is for money. And that's the typical one that everyone thinks about. You know, you have that quote from Trump where he said, "I got a small loan of $1 million from my dad." And it's like, OK, well, that's a big unfair advantage. But there are many different types. There's also I is intelligence and insight. Intelligence comes in many forms, not just the typical kind of, you know, book smarts. You also have like the emotional and social intelligence. You have the creativity. You have insight, which is a unique perspective into a problem. You know, finding a problem that's there in the market or a friction or an inefficiency that's there. Your insight is a great one. And that's usually one that if you think you don't have many unfair advantages, there's often one that you can have just by, you know, your unique circumstances. You might have an insight. Then we move on to L. So we have done M, I, and then we've got L in the framework. It is for location and luck. That's the right place and right time. You know, timing is so important. Location is still important, and you can think of it as virtual location as well. You know, for example, where do you rank on Google's search engine? You know, the rankings. If you're ranking higher, then your location is better. You'll get more traffic to your website. You have education and expertise. That sounds great. Everyone needs to develop their education and expertise. You could do self-learning. You can learn by doing. And the final one is S, which is for status, which is how you're perceived, what people think of you when they first see you, who you know, your network, and also your inner status, which is your confidence and kind of, you know, that ability to just go up to people and feel like you can do this.
As I went through the book and I looked through the stories, it was one of those pieces where, you know, is it in hindsight that we're able to see the unfair advantages, or do people actually, you know, understand that as they're moving forward? One of those to me would be the founder of Spanx and the unfair advantage you felt that they had.
Yeah, so for her, it was quite straightforward. So the founder of Spanx is Sarah Blakely, and she was selling faxes in the 90s door to door. So imagine door to door sales of selling fax machines. She had this unique insight into tights. She thought, okay, tights are great, but they're so hot in this Florida heat. It's just awful. But what about if I cut off the feet? And actually, they're quite good underneath dresses to kind of give you some shape. And she started experimenting with that. And that was her unique insight into this problem that women face. So she had the disadvantage, you could say, of being a woman in business, right? Like that classic thing of you don't fit the stereotype of somebody who I'd give lots of money to who's going to succeed as an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, that kind of still is the case, especially it was in the 90s when she started. And so, but as a woman, her unique insight was into this shapewear business that became Spanx, that became a $1 billion business. So, so for her, she would have known it going in. And in general, they don't, you know, entrepreneurs don't always look into that kind of consciously. And one of the reasons we wrote the book is to say, actually, why don't you do an audit of what you have? What assets do you have going for you already? So that you can start off with the right strategy and you can know who to partner with. Somebody who's got wherever you're weaker, they're stronger. And that's a very strong kind of way of applying in the book, is to partner up with people who have your weaknesses rather than trying to, you know, double down on your strengths rather than your weaknesses, and partner up with people who plug in those gaps.
So it is the stories in the book that sort of resonate and give some life to these concepts. Let's talk a little bit about some examples that you think really exemplify the significance of intelligence and insight. Obviously, you mentioned the Spanx example. Do you have another one?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that if ever you're buying anything online, chances are that it's probably going through a payment processor called Stripe. Now, Stripe is a huge business now. It was founded by two Irish brothers who grew up in rural Ireland, being homeschooled, if I'm remembering correctly, or at least just a kind of a simple kind of upbringing. But they were just super smart, just kind of classic book smart. Patrick, the older brother, he won the Young Scientist of the Year award when he was like 16 years old, and he came up with his own programming language, you know, computer code. And then his brother and John Collison. So it's Patrick Collison and John Collison. His younger brother got the highest possible grade in his basically the Irish equivalent of SATs. And these guys started their business because they thought their unique insight was, you know, we need to make it easy for developers, so the programmers who are behind the websites, to plug in a product for processing transactions. And so they decided to make a a product which is only 10 lines of code. So just 10 lines of code, they copy and paste it into the website. There they go, they can now take payments. So it was that unique ability and also obviously their expertise and how smart they are. So their intelligence was a huge unfair advantage for them.
One of the things that I thought was interesting, because again, you know, what we're talking about is that you don't necessarily need to have all the miles or all the pieces of that you've identified in the book in order to be able to make an advantage. But as well, there has been some discussion of, you know, where can you really, you know, pull together this rags to riches story? You know, we've always heard that the U.S. is a place where people can really start from nothing and make it. So, you know, are you finding with these companies that, you know, is the U.S. still the best place to be able to do that? Or are other countries succeeding in this?
That's a good question. I think I would say that the U.S. is still leading the way, but there are a lot of companies are, from other countries are hot on the heels. So you have a lot of, you know, startups in China. So obviously, as we know, just in general, China is just catching up. And there's a lot of startups in China that are doing really well, even when it comes to like electric vehicles, let's say. Tesla's ahead of everybody, and that's an American startup. But then you have like the only real contenders, it seems, is the Chinese upstarts. So in terms of rags to riches in general, there are a lot of stats. So if you're talking about specifically like rags to riches from the lowest, so you can think, break it up into quintiles, and the lowest 20% of society in terms of wealth to the highest 20%, that social mobility to go from the bottom to the top is actually weirdly more common in Europe, in a lot of the Western European countries, than it is in America. But based on kind of more anecdotal kind of circumstances, it seems to go from the middle to the top can be a lot more stratospheric in America. So this is kind of based on my experience and talking to entrepreneurs in the States and in other places. That seems to be the case, even though from the bottom, it's not as much of, you know, the American dream. It's not as alive and kicking as it may be, I don't know, it once was. But maybe from the middle, and if you're kind of sort of in the middle to get to the top, I think that's still very possible and very much available to people out there who you know, identify their unfair advantages and also work super hard to make it happen.
One of the sort of hotbeds of innovation in this country, as a segue, was Silicon Valley. And you talk about Silicon Valley in your location and luck discussion. Talk to us a little bit about how Silicon Valley is emblematic of the significance of location and luck.
Oh, yeah. Silicon Valley is a fascinating story because it's almost like a character in its own right as a location. You can look at how it grew and how all these kinds of... It's basically like an upward spiral. It's like one thing leads to another that leads to another that makes it kind of accelerate faster and faster. So it started off just being that there were some military bases based there. And so a lot of people in engineering and technology started to be based around there. And then you had the universities like Stanford and others. And then that just became a hotbed. And I think there was specifically one early entrepreneur in semiconductors who moved from New Jersey to Silicon Valley. And it was living there and a combination of other things and them attracting talent from the universities and colleges in that area. That made it kind of accelerate and compound. And it had this almost kind of hockey stick kind of growth where you had all the venture capitalists pop up and that encouraged even more investment in the space. And so it was this virtuous circle that just kept growing in Silicon Valley. So yeah, it's an incredible story and it's a real hotbed of innovation.
But how does that sort of tell us about unfair advantage in particular? The Silicon Valley story is one that we here have been fascinated by a lot. That interesting sort of a mix of Stanford and the military. And is it that the location provides access to lots of smart people? How does it fit into the model?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it fits into the model in the sense that any kind of area that becomes known for a particular industry fits the model. So you can think about Hollywood in a similar way. Mm-hmm. Like, why is it? Well, all the talent comes to Hollywood to make their luck, to get lucky in the show business. In a similar way, thing happens in Silicon Valley. And we can also look at an example. So let's look at Google, for instance. Startups are known to be like done by college dropouts, right? But actually, Google was a PhD thesis in Stanford. It was Sergey Brin and Larry Page who were doing their PhD thesis, and it was called Backrub at the time. It wasn't called Google. And it was this idea of using this academic citation model as a way to create better search engines. And because they were academics, their parents were academics, so you got some unfair advantages there. And then they had mentorship from professors at Stanford. You had investment from people at Stanford as well. And that helped it to actually grow into a company. And so you could see that that all worked out because they were in Stanford and not if they had been somewhere else in the country. It would have been less likely, let's just put it that way.
Right.
When I look again at the Miles formula, you know, we've talked about location now. With regards to status, can you talk about how status can help? But then also status can also work against you as well.
Yeah, so your status is basically your reputation. Or another way to look at it is it's your brand. Think of it as your personal brand. So one thing to look at in investing in general, you look at the sustainable competitive advantages of large companies, and you try and decide, especially when it comes to value investing, the type of investing that Warren Buffett does, let's say, he tries to look at where they have economic moats, sustainable competitive advantages. And essentially, if you scale that down and take that early enough to a company, to the point of a startup, and in a startup in the very early stages, it's the people. And so it becomes the personal brand. So for a company, it might be a brand like Coca-Cola or Apple, but for a person, it will be their personal brand. It will be like their resume or their LinkedIn page. And so status is that. It's just how you're perceived. It's the same as a brand perception. How are you perceived? Are you likely to... So something that's common, for example, is like pattern recognition. Now, this is a problem that's been known about for a long time, and it's kind of a bug of human psychology. It's not so much necessarily, something that can be fully addressed as much as we're working on it and people are working on unconscious biases. But pattern recognition is a common thing that, let's say, the founders of Canva. Canva is this online graphic design company that sort of is putting Photoshop to shame because it's so easy to use. Whereas if you want to learn to use Photoshop, it'll take you months, if not years, just to learn where all the buttons are. Canva, anybody could drag and drop and do it. And this is now a unicorn company worth billions. The founder of it is called Melanie Perkins, along with her now husband. They live in Australia. And there's a big case study of them in the book at the end. And for her, status was a big thing because she was a woman trying to raise funding in Silicon Valley, just getting turned down by hundreds and hundreds of VCs, venture capitalists. And it's because she says, look, I didn't look like Mark Zuckerberg. I didn't look like a 20-something white college dropout, nerdy, awkward kid, right? So I didn't fit that stereotype. I was from Australia. I wanted to start the company in Australia. So it was just much more difficult. It's much more of an uphill battle. So status is all about perception. It's all about who you know. It's all about what doors can open up for you based on that perception. Another easy one is Kylie Jenner, right? She was the biggest self-made billionaire, according to Forbes, in 2019. It's funny to call her self-made because she's been on a TV show, on the Kardashian show, since she was 10 years old. That's what status is all about.
One of the interesting things you talk about in the book, though, is the difference between inner status and outer status. Mm. And the notion that that part of status is something you can control yourself because it's how you project yourself. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So part of status externally, and you hear about this, and there are talks that are very popular, books very popular about things like body language, voice tonality, how to dress to impress, and things like that about how to increase your external status. But the reality is things like, let's say that something like body language, that's trying to reverse engineer somebody who's confident. So if you work on the inner side of it, then you'll project confidence almost automatically. Now, it's useful to work on both. It's useful to work on your it's useful to look at things, and maybe if you're early on and you're quite introverted or shy, maybe you do need to focus a little bit more on how you're making that eye contact when you're shaking somebody's hand, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the external side. But ultimately, it's going to come from the confidence you have in yourself, and it's going to come from your inner status. And when it slows out naturally like that, you don't need to micromanage what you do with your arms. You know what I mean? So you're going to get caught up thinking, what am I doing with my arms? When if you're just more comfortable and more confident, then if you work through it that way, it's much easier. Now, obviously, that's easier said than done. How do you build up self-esteem? How do you build up confidence? A lot of it is just exposure. It's a bit like getting over any phobia. Exposure to it. Like public speaking, I was terrified of when I was younger. And now I enjoy public speaking. I love giving keynote speeches to companies and things like that. And I relish it because it's something I've done more often. Yeah. So a big piece of it is just getting those reps in and getting used to it and then building that confidence. Hey, this isn't so bad. And then the confidence will build and body language will come by itself.
Nope, that is the best way to do it. We've been speaking with author Hassan Kuba, and he was discussing his book, The Unfair Advantage, How You Already Have What It Takes to Succeed. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Utah's Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control is getting a service-first facelift with the launch of its new name and new mission. The DABC Director, Tiffany Gleason, unveiled the department's new mission statement and discussed new service initiatives at an event on June 1st. Tiffany Gleason joins us this morning to talk all about it. Tiffany, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's just start with a brief overview of what the DABC does. What do you oversee and what is your responsibility?
Sure. So we proudly here at the DABS oversee really three main parts of this agency. And so there is a prevention education division and mission. And that sort of encompasses any of our public health and safety work related to preventing overconsumption, preventing underage drinking, and then preventing, you know, DUI related or, you know, impaired driving tragedies. And we work with many partners on that. The second major part of our business is compliance and licensing. And, you know, I think that's one that if you're someone that receives licensing from us, you know very well the ins and outs of that business and interacting with us. But I think the public doesn't realize to a pretty great extent that we do that and how important and critical that work is. These are small, medium, and large sized businesses, many entrepreneurs in the hospitality industry that cannot be successful without a license from us, right? If they want to serve alcohol. And I'm really excited about that division and that mission. Because again, we are helping entrepreneurs realize their entrepreneurial dream, and really for us to be supportive in that mission and that role is really important. So I like talking about that so that people make that connection about that work we do and how it supports entrepreneurs, businesses, and adds to our hospitality and tourism industries here in Utah. And then the third part of our business, which I think maybe people quickly identify with when they hear about our agency, is our retail operations, right? And so, you know, we have over 50 stores, and then there are some package agencies that we contract with on an independent contractor basis. And they're all over the state where people can go and buy alcoholic beverage products straight from us if it's, you know, High Point beer, wine, or spirits. So those are the three main aspects of our business and what we do here at the DABS.
Talk to us a little bit about why you felt the need to sort of issue a new mission statement and how the mission of the agency has changed, if at all.
Sure. So when I came on board, you know, a little over 15 months ago and had been talking with the governor in preparation for transitioning into this role, speaking with our legislative partners that really do incredible work in this really complicated space, it was clear to me that we needed to have a plan. We're a half a billion dollar public enterprise, and we had never had a plan, a roadmap. So immediately we created a short-term strategic plan, and then what we've just released in the last 2 weeks, which is a more comprehensive, detailed, multi-year strategic plan. And really is important because it serves as a roadmap for what we want to do to serve our customers moving forward over the next couple of years. But I'll tell you what's more exciting than even having a roadmap, which is important. It's how we built that roadmap. And we built that collaboratively. The governor had a team of people that worked on a transition report while he was waiting to take office. And that transition report, it was really compelling in two major ways. It said, you know, there's not a lot of clarity. We don't understand how this agency measures itself. What does it think success is, and how does it communicate and measure that success? And the other sort of big compelling comment that came out of that transition report was that we kind of work in a silo, but there's not a lot of collaboration. And I did, when I came on board, I felt that immediately. That's not a bad thing or an indictment on years previous, but it definitely was clear to me, we can do better and we need to do better. So we built that plan collaboratively with all of our stakeholders, law enforcement, prevention, the hospitality industry, and also people that we serve in the retail sector, in trying to understand who are our customers and how can we serve them better. So I was really excited to launch that. And I think out of that whole process, really, Roger, to answer your question, it became clear we are a government agency. We are a regulator as one of our main roles, but that doesn't mean that it's a binary proposition. And it doesn't mean we can't be service focused, that we can't really strive to have the best customer service and really realize that public servant role while also doing these other things. They're not, again, it's not a binary proposition. It's not adversarial in nature. And so that's how we kind of came through the process of really understanding and hoping to move forward with these service focused mission.
And I think the piece where you see that the most is the change in the name. So the name was previously Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control. Control meaning, like, is that where your success is? Is that how you're measured? Where now you're changing it to services. So when you're looking at making this department service friendly, what does that mean? I mean, it doesn't mean that you're making alcohol available everywhere all the time necessarily. What are now your measurement factors on that?
Sure. I think it's important to note, you know, the name change came because the lawmakers who work in this space really understood how we wanted to move forward, our vision, our mission moving forward, and agreed that while the main role of being a control state, that's not changing. We're not unicorns. There are 18 control states here in America. We're one of those. And to every, you know, to some extent, whether you're a control state or what we call a licensed state, alcohol is still regulated in every single state in America. And that's not a bad thing, because we know that there are consequences to, again, overconsumption, et cetera, when it comes to these products. And so regulation is appropriate, and we are still a control state. However, really being able to just change that one word and focus on service, it better reflects who we are as an agency. And again, it's not just control, which comes down to our licensing and compliance, right? Part of our business, our regulatory mission. Yes, we still do that. And we're still going to do that. We're still focused on public safety and health. But it better encompasses the other things that we do. Prevention education, which honestly serves every single Utahn, whether you drink alcoholic beverage products or not. Through our prevention education work, we are working for every Utahn. You can see that through the Parents Empowered campaign and working with children to help make sure that they reach their full potential in adulthood, alcohol-free, with a healthy brain. Another way that we work for all Utahns is through the hundreds of millions of dollars that we generate, right? That goes straight back into the general fund and local economies to provide things like public safety, school lunch program, transportation. All of those things are a great benefit. And then obviously, we also provide those retail services, right? So I think you're correct. The idea of incorporating services into our name was not, you know, it's not a free-for-all from that perspective. It just better reflects what we do. And it also serves as sort of an aspirational guidepost for where we as a workforce, me as a leader, want to always be aspiring to be. That is service focused for every single one of our customers, which is every single Utahn.
You certainly emphasize the importance of the hospitality industry and its relationship with your agency. Talk to us a little bit about whether you see any changes coming as a result of pressures from the hospitality issues or needs of the hospitality industry, in particular, if there were to be part of a pursuit for the next Olympic Games.
Sure. I mean, it's really important for me to be clear. I am not a legislator. I don't make laws.
But you have a crystal ball.
And so the legislature does a great job doing that. And I know there are many people in the hospitality industry and the tourism industry that do interface and really advocate for changes that they'd like to see for things like the NBA All-Star Game, for things like a future Olympics, which I think we all really, really want to see, right? And we're all hopeful that we're able to win a second bid there. I do think and do believe that our state government, from the governor to the legislative branch and many others, we realize the value of our tourism industry, and not only just regular old rec tourism, but business tourism, sports tourism. We're on a main stage now, again, with the NBA All-Star Games coming up within this next year. We're on a global stage, and we have so much to offer, whether it's in St. George hosting the Ironman for the first time outside of Hawaii, or for something like the Olympics. And so I do believe that the legislature absolutely sees the value that these big events bring, and really our ability to showcase how well we treat visitors, right, and how well we can do things. And so I do feel like there will be a lot of success between the legislature and the hospitality industry figuring out what is appropriate and what's right, so that we're poised to be the best hosts again for another Olympics. And I guess if you would allow me to follow up quickly from my perspective, because obviously I'm operations focused, we enact the laws that are given to us. So from an operations perspective, we're on it. I can tell you, I absolutely see the value. Our leadership teams here sees the value. We're already working very closely with our NBA All-Star partners on how we can help them be successful. And we'll do the same thing with the Olympics.
From an operations perspective, the KPCW studio sits proudly atop a liquor store here on Sweet Alley that's been closed a lot. Tell us a little bit about your issues with staffing and how that's going to be addressed.
Sure. I believe it was 7 or 8 days into my tenure here at the agency. I was faced with one of my first really difficult decisions. We're still very much in the pandemic. And then, of course, labor shortages related to direct COVID exposures, and then just labor shortages related to external market factors there. We were in the middle of ski season, and we did for several weeks shut down that store so that we could allocate the staffing resources to really shore up the two larger, busier stores. There's a lot of value in that store on Sweet Alley. Anytime I'm there on Main Street, I love to stop by. I think it's convenient. It's a great neighborhood there. And we do have a commitment to stay there and to have a presence there. This is not just us, right, that has staffing issues in Park City. Other retailers, the resorts, everyone experiences the stresses there of it being a higher cost of living. So it's very difficult for people to actually live in the market area there in Park City. And so they have to commute in. And that's an obstacle to bringing on your and recruiting workforce. And then obviously keeping up with compensation. But again, I have to give the legislature a lot of credit. The governor, the legislature really pulled through in helping us start to address our compensation issues. This summer, our employees will be receiving another raise. And again, we can't stop there. We need to continually be addressing and reevaluating compensation, which we will now be able to do as a result of SB 137 passed last year. So that's exciting news.
We have talked about the Sweet Alley Liquor Store. There's other locations, whether it be in Kimball Junction, Snow Creek Drive, or there on Sidewinder for the restaurants and bars. What I've come to hear is that, Park City does generate a large amount of sales of liquor and alcohol, and that the Snow Creek store is one of the most successful in Utah. How are the revenues used? Are they earmarked and can only be used for specific projects? Do any portions stay within the community, or does it just go into the general fund for the state?
Sure. It's probably a lot of complexity in giving you a really detailed answer, but I think broad strokes, is of course when those transactions happen, right, a portion of that does go back into the community, right, either through county or municipal revenue structure. And then any of those other monies, essentially, there's a couple of line items where like Parents Empowered, right, is statutorily like so many percent immediately goes there. School lunch program immediately goes there. Beyond that, everything goes back to the general fund. And then, of course, the legislature makes those decisions. We hopefully, right, put forth really strong business cases on what our operational needs are moving forward. And if they believe in us and trust us, then they invest in us. One thing I can tell you is this last legislative session, we received historic levels of investment from the legislature. I am very proud of that. It's the first time we've had that, over $10 million that we've received to be able to launch new programs, again, that are service focused, that are IT driven. And so it's now my responsibility, right, to lead a team and make sure we deliver, not only for the people in the state of Utah that will use these services, but to the legislature, so that we can continue to build credibility, be responsible with those dollars, and that we can hopefully receive additional investment in the future.
We've heard anecdotally that people are buying more expensive products from our liquor stores. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on and why do you think it's happening?
Sure. You know, I was just at a NABCA conference last week, which is a big conference for all of the control states. And, you know, there's a regulatory function, but there's also a big vendor interaction function where you're getting the latest updates from industry. Where's the market going there? What are the trends in alcoholic beverage consumership, et cetera? And what I can tell you is, yes, people are absolutely buying premium, and they're really buying premium spirits. I mean, when you look at it sort of big picture, right? And a lot of that is down to the pandemic. For a while, people were not going to bars, restaurants like they used to. And so it's like, oh, great. Well, I'm stuck here at my house and I've just spent, you know, 9 hours working in my home office. I'm not going to go out tonight. I want to try to tackle that handmade cocktail, right, that I've been seeing on people's Instas. And I don't want just the bottom shelf gin or what, you know, I want top shelf. I want premium. And so really that kind of has led to that premium trend in people's consumership. I'll also say that here in the state of Utah, we have huge population growth with a lot of disposable income. So our demographics are changing in terms of people coming into the state and people who are consuming alcoholic and purchasing alcoholic beverage products. And to a great degree, a lot of that population increase has more disposable income and therefore can be a bit more choosy when it comes to the types of products that they wish to buy. So yes, I can confirm that that is the case. And I will tell you that it really is driven in the spirit category.
Before we wrap up our interview, I just wanted to have you talk a little bit again about that Parents Empowered, the safety education pieces that you do, because I know that on the liquor store in Prospector Square, there's a piece that's going to be coming up. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, I say that the work we do in our prevention education, especially with Parents Empowered program, is the most important work that we do. And I say that because I'm a mom who has a child, and in a couple of years, a second child who will be in that demographic. You should start talking and having these conversations and bonding with your children about these type of topics starting at age 9. Between 9 and 12 are those critical years, because you kind of lose them right after that to many respects, right? Then their interests kind of change. So this work is very important. I absolutely believe in the work that Parents Empowered does. And it's really about bonding, establishing those relationships so that your children trust you to have conversations with you as they get older about you know, alcoholic beverages, if they're in difficult situations with their peer groups on down the road, that they feel like they can come to you and have a partner, right? A trusted partner and someone who can help them out. One of the really neat projects that you referenced is we've had a partnership with Encircle and working with them, because we have a lot of sort of the same shared problems, shared mission in terms of making sure that you have that bonding time, that you're establishing those relationships of trust with your children, because we know that the people that Encircle serve, right, oftentimes are struggling with some really difficult issues. Oftentimes they feel alienated, they feel alone, They feel like they don't have a support group. And that's what Encircle is there to do, is to provide a support group for our LGBTQ youth. So there's a lot of really shared focus there and shared outcomes. So we're partnering with them. We have a mural that is going to go up on the back of our Prospector Square store. I, in fact, get to attend a meeting tonight where they're going to review all of, they did a call for an artist call for designs. And so I'll be able to be on the sidelines kind of looking through all of the different designs that came in. And we'll be really excited to unveil that and very publicly be able to show our support to our partner Encircle and really a shared message that we believe that every child is important, and whatever your child's journey is, let's go together. So we'll make sure that we bring you, that you're aware of that. We would love to have you come see the mural as we all celebrate this really great project. It looks like it's going to be, the launch event will likely be in September when the mural's complete. So it should be a really fun time.
Sounds great. Tiffany, you've gotten a lot done within your first 15 months at the DABS. We've been speaking with Director of the DABS, Tiffany Clayson. Tiffany, thank you for joining us this morning.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Serving high vibes at high altitude, Guesthouse Juicery and Cafe offers cold-pressed juices, superfood smoothies, salads, healthy foods, and more. This morning, Jennifer Sutton, owner of Guesthouse Juicery and Cafe, joins us. Jennifer, thanks for coming this morning.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin with you telling us about what inspired you to create the Guesthouse Juicery and Cafe.
Yeah, so we moved to Park City full-time, myself and my family. I have two small children. In August of 2019, we've been coming out here, though, for a number of years. We got married out here, so we had a lot of roots in Park City. So we moved. I'd been working in advertising and marketing for 15 years. COVID sets in. Lots of things were changing. And the way I was eating, I'd always been a healthy cook, a healthy eater, but during COVID, even more so. Then I started to find myself going down to Salt Lake a lot as things opened back up for items like fresh cold pressed juices, became a really big nut milk fan, got really tiresome to do a lot of it at home, making salads all the time. And so I really started to feel like there was this void in our market for some place that was healthy. It was relatively fast and just easy options for good, healthy food. So the bug was sort of there. I'd gone to school for hospitality, and then I'd worked in media and marketing for 15 years, but I'd always wanted to get back to hospitality. So that was part of the story. Set out looking for a potential location. I was really focused in on the Prospector area. We live not too far from there down the road. I loved this idea that it felt like this up and coming locals first area. That was very important to me as we thought about opening the cafe. And we found what was the recently vacated Gazebo Hair Salon. And so we set out upon converting that into what is now Guesthouse Juicery and Cafe.
And where is that location for people, for our listeners who might want to come visit you?
Sure. We are at 1800 Prospector Avenue. We're located on the ground floor. We have some signage up across the windows. We're looking at getting a larger sign. We're a little tucked in the back there, kind of in that back corner of that parking lot. And so our door entrance backs up to the Barrett Lane, you know, sort of square that's back there in the middle of the Prospector Square area.
So I understand that your juices are cold pressed. What does that mean and why does it matter?
Sure. So we have a giant cold press machine right at the cafe in Prospector, which is where we make the juices. And what that essentially is this kind of looks like a robot. We load all the produce into this big tube. There's blades in there that shred the produce down. It falls into what's essentially a press bag. And then there's these big hydraulic presses that then press the liquid out of the produce, and then we bottle it from there. So the reason that that's important and a bit different than when you might go into a different type of juice shop and sort of order something and they make it in that juicer that spins around and then the liquid comes out, is that it reduces heat in the process. So when you cold press, because you don't have as much heat and oxygen, you retain more of the vitamins, the enzymes, and the minerals than you might in a centrifugal juicer. And it also allows us to get more liquid out of the juice because you're exerting so much pressure onto the produce shreds. You're able to just extract a lot of liquid, which obviously is better for sustainability and just general consumption of the product. So there's health benefits to it. You also get a longer shelf life out of it. The enzymes are retained longer. So we then bottle everything, and you can get about 5 days off of a juice once it's cold pressed.
It's good to note. And when I looked at your menu, it's not just like, you know, mango or apple. You have combinations. How did you put them together, and what do you seek with those?
So when we first started working with the menu, we did a lot of sampling. Whenever we went somewhere, we tested juices at a lot of different juice places. We wanted to open with something that was approachable, covered your health bases. So we have our detox greens, which is all greens, no fruit. Then we have an easy greens, that's a lot of greens and some apples. So it's a bit more approachable in terms of someone who's nervous to go down, you know, the all greens route. We wanted a mix of roots and fruits as well. So beet is an incredible superfood. We have a couple of beet juices. Seasonality, we're this week or next switching the menu over to start to incorporate more summer flavors. So it really was about keeping in mind people's palates, what they're interested in, health benefits, low sugar options, medium sugar options, and then the different benefits of the different vegetables. So celery is an incredible vegetable for juicing. We have a straight celery juice. We have our morning greens. That's celery, apple, lemon, and ginger. When you start your day with celery, you're really doing a lot for inflammation in your body, sugar cravings, things like that. And then those are conversations we have when people come into the store also. Some people want to grab things and get out, and that's great. Some people really want to talk about what are the health benefits. When there was a COVID surge happening in the early winter, we had a lot of customers coming in asking about ways to keep themselves healthy, juices they could get for friends of theirs that weren't feeling well. So there's been a lot of reward in that also, being able to help people through some of their health things.
In addition to juices, I know you also feature smoothies. Talk to us a little bit about your smoothie menu and what you've done that's unusual and interesting.
Sure. So with the smoothie menu, we try to really focus on superfoods, not a lot of sort of filler ingredients. So not putting orange juice into the smoothies, for example, but really trying to keep them delicious, healthy, satisfying, but not overly sugary, or, you know, we wanted to keep them just good and healthy. So we have a lot of your sort of things you might expect, like a strawberry banana, but we add maca to that, for example. So that's an adaptogen that helps with stress response and fatigue and things like that. So we made it easy for people to try new things in that regard. We have a mint chip smoothie that's really popular. Again, not going too sweet with that, but it really satisfies that sort of ice cream kind of craving. We have the options for gluten-free oats in all of our smoothies. So we want people to know us as somewhere that they can go if they have dietary restrictions that we're working with, and really just a mix of flavor profiles, continuing to update that menu. We brought in La Coco, which is a local brand started by two women. It's like a functional mushroom hot chocolate. And now we're doing a smoothie with that that's become incredibly popular. So just trying to continuously discover new things and bring those into the menu.
So, you know, you are a juicery as well as a cafe. Can you let customers know what to expect when they walk in your front doors, and what else is on your menu?
So when you walk in, you'll have our grab-and-go coolers kind of off to the right. We have some shelves with some great health and retail merchandise products. So we've worked hard to curate a really great selection of adaptogens, functional mushrooms, different things that you can incorporate into your daily life as well. And then we've also been continuously expanding the menu since we opened to include more, like I said, healthy, fast foods that people can grab. So we now have 6 salads. We've started a make your own salad, so you can actually come in and customize a salad. We make all of our dressings in-house. Some of the most popular are the vegan Caesar, which is shredded kale and Brussels sprouts. And then we have a vegan Caesar dressing that we make in-house. It uses cashews instead of any dairy. Our dairy-free ranch is incredibly popular. So you'll find 3 or 4 salads in the case that you can grab and go, 3 or 4 that are made to order. We have some toasts and sandwiches, overnight oats, the smoothies. So we've really rounded out the menu so that you can come in pretty much from breakfast through sort of that early dinner time to find something easy and quick and good for you.
So we've been speaking with Guesthouse Juicery and Cafe. Can you let us know again where our listeners can find out more?
Yes. So you can come visit us at 1800 Prospector Avenue. You can follow us on social. We're on Instagram at GuesthousePC, and house is spelled H-A-U-S. Also our website is www.guesthousepc.com. And you can visit us to dine in. We have seating that sits up front in our space, looks up at the rail trail and the mountain. It's really quite beautiful. You can come in for grab and go, and you can also do delivery or pickup.
We've been speaking with Jennifer Sutton. She is the owner of the Guesthouse Juicery and Cafe. Jennifer, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for the time.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.